Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
The attorneys at Gingras, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work. If you want a personal attorney that can help you in so many different areas, they've got them. They're in Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. They're easy to reach. GTWLawyers.com. That's GTWLawyers.com. Welcome to another podcast at Sly'sOffice.com. Joining us today, Peter Rickman from the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers. Peter, welcome to the show. I just want to thank a couple of our sponsors here as we get started. Madison Teamsters, Local 695, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Firefighters, Local 311, as well as the Operating Engineers, Local 139. All right. So, Peter, we are here to talk about the platform today, the Democratic platform.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on to talk about this.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled to have a chance to talk about what we're doing to put forward the most advanced and progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party. That certainly is my objective in being part of this process as a member of the platform committee from Wisconsin, representing Bernie Sanders.
That is awesome. All right. So tell me what the process is and what's going on.
Well, Sly, I think, some of your listeners may have some familiarity with the way the Democratic Party platform gets developed, and all of us have some familiarity with how it does and does not get implemented in office. But this is a little unique, and because of the race between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, and the pretty strong relationship between these two former Senate colleagues, we've had a few additional steps in this process that have given everyday people a chance to weigh in on what should be in the Democratic Party platform. It started with a series of task forces that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders together created to work out some of the issues that, may have posed philosophical divides between the two candidates on the campaign trail, but are not necessarily something that ultimately divides Democrats. And they put together a series of task forces that included supporters of both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden to hammer out what they called a unity proposal. The platform drafting committee would take up these the product of these task forces, and they talked about climate change. They talked about criminal justice reform. They talked about education. They talked about jobs and the economy and labor. They talked about health care. And these task forces worked for 6 weeks to put together a series of recommendations to go to the platform drafting committee. And then the platform drafting committee, which is it consists of appointees of Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, as well as the DNC, wrestled with that amongst a host of other issues to figure out what they would put in front of the Democratic National Committee Convention Platform Committee, of which I'm a member. One of the really great parts about this process, Sly, is that regular people have had a chance to weigh in on the platform through that drafting process and testify in front of that committee, as well as submit their own points of view on this. So what's come out of the platform drafting committee, which will be released today or tomorrow, then goes to the platform committee, which will meet on Monday to take up potential amendments to that and send it along to the folks who are attending the DNC convention here in Milwaukee in about a month. And that's where we'll approve a Democratic Party platform for 2020, and hopefully a blueprint for the new Biden administration.
I just sadly canceled my reservations at the Red Roof Inn.
Frankly, Sly, I'm a little disappointed that you didn't ask to sleep on my couch. You could have just.
I am too old to be sleeping on people's couches. If I get on that couch, I'm not getting back up.
Well, it's a fine couch. Don't think I haven't fallen asleep many a night on there while reading my materials. Although never falling asleep when reading my materials for preparing to participate in the Democratic Party platform drafting process.
All right,
this material is scintillating.
Let's take a step back. When it comes to platforms,
Why do they matter?
Well, I think party platforms, you know, in the United States are symbolic documents. You know, in a number of countries around the world, what goes into the party platform and who's elected to office inside the party organization really matters. It has a direct relationship to governing if that party is in power. In the United States, that's, you know, long since ceased to be our model. But the party platform does a couple things. First of all, I think the party platform declares, you know, sort of at a baseline, the values of the potentially incoming, you know, governing administration. So I think the party platform that we're talking about and working towards right now says where the Biden administration is at. It outlines not only its bottom lines in terms of, well, this is definitely where we need to be at, and it also says where they're not going to be at. And I think there's a great value in that. And I would be a little concerned if we adopted a Democratic Party platform that says Joe Biden is going to do Medicare for all in the first 100 days of his administration, because Joe Biden has said that's not where he's at. But what this party platform process has allowed us to do is work things out amongst those of us who are supporters of Medicare for all and a robust role for the public sector in delivering health care for everyone, every American by right, and those folks in the Biden camp who are not committed to that. And so what's come out of this platform process is a really strong, and I'm excited to support what's coming out of this, a public option program that looks a lot like a path to Medicare for all. So this platform process has given us a chance to reconcile some of these philosophical, ideological, and policy differences between those who ostensibly might be coming into power, the Biden administration, and those of us who are pushing further and further than where that candidate has been willing to go during the primaries. So I think this platform process gives us an opportunity to reconcile some of the divides in the party over policy preferences, over ideology. And I think the platform process also declares for the American voter, as well as the incoming administration staff, here's the blueprint for governing. You know, I think this platform is not something where those of us who are participating in the process are necessarily legislating, but we're declaring the direction for on day one, what will a Biden administration do? And I think if this party platform provides that sort of blueprint to the Biden administration, we could see a pretty dramatic shift here in what happens for the average American working person in their day-to-day life. And I think that's the sort of thing that can inspire voters to say, yeah, I got to get out in October to cast my ballot by mail or to my poll in place on election day in November. Not only beat Trump, but, you know, elect Joe Biden.
So Nicholas Kristof was on MSNBC the other day, and I don't always agree with him, but he made an interesting point about this pandemic and the other things that are going on right now actually creating an opportunity for things that never would have happened otherwise, like Medicare for all. That, you know, much like the Depression brought us the New Deal, that there's a window of opportunity. You know, I wonder how many things that Franklin Roosevelt worked on in his first couple terms were in the Democratic platform back in 1932.
Oh, virtually none of it.
So, there's a window of opportunity here.
Absolutely. I'm struck by the climate change section of the working draft for the platform and what's come out of the task forces that I mentioned before. You know, the Democratic Party platform right now does not include, in order, the three words green, new, and deal. But if you look at the content in there, you see a massive jobs program putting people to work. And it's very explicit about this lie. It's putting people to work in living wage union jobs. This Democratic Party platform is not shy and it is not brief when it comes to saying that we need to rebuild our economy and retool it around clean energy with union jobs. This Democratic Party platform right now talks about a just transition and says we're not going to leave behind the working class people in the coal fields. We're not going to leave behind the folks in the building trades, for example, who've made decent livelihoods, supported their families for generations on projects based around an energy economy that is now a relic of the 20th century that's unsustainable. And I think that's part of how we're going to break the logjam on things like climate change that are an existential threat this Democratic Party platform is now taking up the necessity, the urgency of confronting this threat of climate change, but doing so in a way that puts people to work in living wage union jobs. We're looking at a pandemic economic crisis right now, Sly, where given the number of people who are unemployed, it alone would be just a total shock to our system. But half of the jobs that have been lost in this pandemic may never be coming back. They may be gone forever. So what are we going to do?
Such as? What type of jobs?
Well, I'm saying this is how economists have looked at things and said, well, these jobs just may not be coming back. We're in too big of a hole, and a bunch of this sort of work isn't going to need to be done. And when the economy does recover, this is not the kind of thing that people are going to be coming back to work in. You know, the capital is not there for it. But what I think we're seeing here is the folks who are working on putting together a governing blueprint for a Biden administration in this platform are saying, you know what, this is our opportunity to put millions and millions of people to work in living wage union jobs. You know, maybe they've been paid poverty wages and certainly haven't had a union, and you know, their job that they've lost in this pandemic, and that is incredibly unfortunate. And I got to say, I feel for the billions of people who are struggling right now. But can you imagine what our economy would look like if those folks were put to work in living wage union jobs, retooling a clean energy economy for the 21st century? I think this pandemic and the other urgent crises that our country confronts are demanding that sort of bold action. And I think what's happening in this Democratic Party platform is that folks are recognizing that's going to take that scale of aggressive and visionary policymaking to address these crises, whether it's the pandemic, whether it's climate change, or fill in the blank with any number of crises that has grown or become worse in the last 4 years of the Trump administration.
How do you use this platform that you say is going to be the most progressive the Democrats have ever put out and use it as a cudgel? And I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I think Joe Biden's going to win. And I think the Democrats are going to probably control all three branches of government. But you know, when all the euphoria dies down and members of Congress settle down, the lobbyists are still going to be there, Peter. They're not going away. And I look back to, I've got a keen memory for what happened in 93 and 94 with NAFTA, the Telecommunications Act that came a little later on. The repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. I think about the Obama administration going back on not signing the Colombia, Panama, and South Korea free trade deal. You know, I go down a litany of these things, and there were a lot of things in previous platforms that opposed all those things, but nobody used the platform as a cudgel to stop corporate America from usurping a political party.
Well, I think there's a couple of big differences between, let's say, an incoming Biden administration in 2021 and the world we faced in 2009 when Barack Obama took office, or in 1993 when Bill Clinton took office. I think that distinct difference is that there is an awoken actual left in America that the Sanders campaign brought forward and helped consolidate. It's a set of forces, not just a few activists here and there, but some real popular forces and social movement organization that is out there fighting for things like Medicare for All and isn't going to stop just because Joe Biden was elected. I think a lot of the forces that we're talking about here are not the kind of people who are saying, oh, great, everything's going to be fine now. We've elected Joe Biden. I think there were a lot of people who felt that way, you know, when Barack Obama was elected. I think they felt like, oh, this was the progressive candidate. And that is, in fact, not true right now with Joe Biden potentially taking office. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. We still got to fight through November to do that. I think, you know, after 12 years of Reagan Bush, when Bill Clinton took office, you know, folks of the Democratic Party exhaled a sigh of relief and sort of demobilized. I think in this moment, there are a set of forces who are going to continue pushing, whether it's for Medicare for All, whether it's for a Green New Deal, whether it's for unions for all, whether it's for free college, that, you know, are activists, are fighters, are, you know, and have an articulated political program. They know what they want and are going to keep pushing to get that. And that is going to create the dynamic here for a Biden administration and some of the more conventional mainstream Democratic Party forces to say, well, we've got our blueprint here. This is what we said we're going to do. Joe Biden or Treasury Secretary whomever, or, you know, Health and Human Services Secretary whomever. This is what, you know, folks said we were going to do. We needed to do this because these Medicare for All folks, these Green New Deal folks, they're not giving up. And I think if we demobilize after Joe Biden is elected, I think you're right. We'll end up in that same sort of situation.
Well, same goes with judges. You know, frankly, Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan are not really great when it comes to economic progressivism. Right?
I think that you'd be hard-pressed to find too many judges in the federal court system who have, you know, an orientation towards the working class life. It's just...
Lynn Edelman's pretty good.
Look, Lynn Edelman is great. and for your listeners who don't know, Lynn Edelman is a federal circuit court judge here in the Eastern District of the Seventh Circuit and has issued a number of rulings that have actually explicitly taken the side of working people. The reality is...
And he called out the Roberts Court for what they've done.
Right. You know, like...
He got in trouble for that, and I think he should wear it as a badge of honor.
Sly, I'm a proud law school dropout.
And, you know, I'm just a college dropout, so there you go.
Well, I'm a higher class of dropout, I guess. You know, when I look around and see the folks with whom I shared a law school... class at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, amongst the finest institutions in all the land, and I'm not disparaging these folks at all. They're not the kind of people who, you know, in that 4 years of undergraduate college education and 3 years of legal training, and maybe some others have had even more schooling or other experiences than that. They're not the sort of folks that I look around and say, this is an outsider fighting on behalf of the working class. Becoming part of the legal profession inherently is accommodating yourself to a system that has a set of rules rigged by the elite and the upper class. So I'm not surprised to hear that folks have reached their
well. Now that Russ Feingold's at the American Constitution Society, maybe that'll help.
I think people like Russ Feingold can have a really big impact on that. I think Russ Feingold can have a really big impact on a lot of things. Fly, you know, my bias is there. And, you know, it's been one of the great joys of this Democratic Party platform process to work with, you know, a former Russ Feingold staff person who was actually a senior advisor and the policy director for the Sanders campaign, Josh Orton, another Wisconsinite. I mean, how cool is this? We got a couple of Wisconsin boys running around trying to make this.
Troublemakers. Well, we have is troublemakers. All right, we're going to pause here. Peter Rickman with us. From the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers at Sly's Office.com.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep Sly's Office.com up and going so you keep up to date. Whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from Sly'sOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
We're back at Sly'sOffice.com, brought to you by Madison Computer Works, also Jeff's Guitar Clinic, and the law firm of Gingrich, Thompson, and Walks. All right, so... I want to talk to you a little bit about something that, you know, obviously with the convention coming to Milwaukee and it's going to be a small group and everything, I don't want to forget the workers that you represent. Can you give us an update on people's lives and what they're going through right now?
Oh, how much time you got?
We've got another 13 minutes. Go.
Well, Sly, the truth is, for folks in the service and hospitality sectors, the economic crisis born of the pandemic has been a bloodbath. And I think it's no surprise for your listeners, for someone like me to say, look, before the pandemic, it's not as if there wasn't an ongoing and burning economic crisis for service sector workers. I mean, real wages have been flat, stagnant or declining in many people's case for decades. you know, the lack of health care coverage, the, you know, the total absence of any sort of retirement security on top of that, and the lack of just union density and real worker rights on the job has been a burning crisis for folks in the service and hospitality industry for decades now. We're working on changing that here with MASH, but, you know, the pandemic threw so many people out of work, and they're struggling. They're struggling mightily. You know, the 8 years of the Walker administration re-rigging the rules of the unemployment system and hamstringing the bureaucracy has just made it utterly terrible for folks who are thrown out of work and need that lifeline. And make no mistake, this doesn't have anything to do with Tony Evers or Caleb Frostman at the Department of Workforce Development and the unemployment system. This has everything to do with the Walker administration, Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald making life tough on working people who, you know, suffer the indignity of losing a job and an economy built around you only survive if you got work. So, you know, for service and hospitality workers losing work, already struggling with low-wage employment before that, not having a safety net in the United States that actually looks out for workers, but instead is geared around what a corporations and bosses want, it's been pretty tough. And now the indignity for a lot of these workers and having the convention get scaled back and not having those few days of work, having the convention taken out of the world-class venue that is the Pfizer Forum, it's been pretty tough. And honestly, Sly, I think a lot of our members have found solace in what our union is doing to just keep fighting, whether it's at City Hall for a people's pandemic response. We've been moving a campaign there to get City of Milwaukee policymakers to take up what working people need. Or even being involved in providing, you know, input and suggestions on this Democratic Party platform process. You know, our union doesn't give up the fight just because our members aren't at work at their job or we represent them under the law. You know, we're a union. We're a workers' organization. We're a fighting labor movement organization that is, you know, putting these very same workers in the struggle that it's going to take to win from the boss class. And that doesn't stop just because they're not currently employed. And so we've taken it as a point of pride, but also a point of necessity that our union has to keep fighting, whether it's to get people their unemployment benefits or to rewrite the rules of this system at the city level, the state level, the federal level.
Why aren't they getting $2,000 a month, like Canada? Or why isn't their rent obligation being dismissed like in France and in other countries in Europe?
Well, Sly, I think we both know the answer to that. It's because, you know, our political system has been controlled by the boss class for so long, and they've rigged the system. They've written the rules to their benefit at the expense of working people. You know, the truth is we could get over this pandemic in about 6 weeks. We could end the coronavirus if we had a government that simply paid people to stay at home. That's it. Let's pay people to stay at home and, by the way, have public health care, not this employment-based, private market commodity, commercial insurance baloney.
Even if you take the immorality of that system, it doesn't work anymore with our economics. It just doesn't.
Well, I would argue, Sly, that an employment-based health insurance system has never worked. It's just now being exposed for the debacle and the monstrosity that it is. In this pandemic, maybe the only good thing that'll come out of this pandemic is that we've seen exposed the flaws in our system. And I think, you know, to your question about why we don't have people being paid to stay at home with a guarantee of health care and a right to return to gainful, secure employment, is that the American working class here has not had, you know, the political strength and the economic strength to frankly, you know, scare the bosses into providing those sort of even meager social welfare protections as a way to stave off any greater militancy. And I think it's going to take a longer term assault on the political system that's, you know, controlled by the boss class. I think it's going to take, you know, ongoing organization by working class people. So folks need to get involved in building, you know, political organizations that represent the needs of the working class. And push.
You know, we have these wild swings in American politics where there's a reaction to an action. Something tells me that we wouldn't have had the debacle in 1994 or 2010 if Democrats had actually use their newly found power with universal power to actually make an immediate difference in people's lives. And I think as people think about ahead to 2022, they need to think about that we have a very short window to make a huge difference in people's lives. And that has to happen, or this country could easily swing back to a deceitful demagogue like Donald Trump. And maybe the next guy or gal will have more political skills and not be so as outrageously, cravenly criminal.
Well, Sly, I think you're hitting on just something absolutely crucial for Democrats, for progressive forces, for social movement organizations, us in the labor movement. We cannot simply walk through from the inauguration to, let's call it the fall of 2022, as you said, some happy talk about how getting rid of Trump is you know, stabilizing the economy and it's growing again. That's the same baloney sandwiches we heard from the Obama-Biden administration in 2009 and their acolytes and defenders, you know, scolding any of us for raising up a critique of what they were doing or, more appropriately, not doing. We cannot fall for that same trap again, because we will end up, as you said, you know, putting someone like a Tom Cotton in the White House, a dangerous demagogue, a proto-fascist with far better political skills than Donald Trump, and that will mean the end of a democracy here. So it's on all of us to hold accountable a potential Biden administration to deliver for working people, not let half measures count, and not say that, you know, rhetoric and pretty words about how things are being fixed substitute for a real program that delivers results for the American working class. But I also think that we can't just sit here and say we won't accept that. I think it's on us to continue to push the same way a lot of folks have over the last 4 years pushing back on the Trump administration. We need to push to have the Biden administration take up our most urgent needs, delivering health care for all Americans by right, addressing the existential threat of climate change by putting millions of people to work retooling a clean energy economy, delivering on unions for all as a way to transform the lives of working people and our jobs. You know, the list goes on. We need to continue to be in the streets so we don't end up in a situation where folks are saying, just tell people that things are getting better and everything will be okay.
Well,
that won't work.
You were involved, in the fight against Act 10 in 2011. It's how I met you. answer this question for me. If Wisconsin state workers and county workers and municipal workers had had the right to strike, if they'd had the right to strike and shut the state down, would Act 10 have succeeded?
You know, it's interesting, Sly, because I don't know in that moment if that were possible. And it's a counterfactual that we can't really address, because the reality is the right to strike on paper doesn't mean a damn thing if you don't have a culture of militancy, and if you don't really believe in the power of a strike. And it's, you know, over the years, I think public employee unions have forgotten that the power of the working class is our power to withdraw consent from this system of labor, and that means striking. And running a strike isn't, you know, some president of a union getting out there saying, we're going on strike, and everybody following. Building a successful strike involves a culture of militancy and a culture of mutual accountability for everyone's success.
Well, let me tell
a culture of solidarity.
Let me tell you, 1976 Madison teachers went on strike. The strike was led by John Matthews, but he obviously had the support of his members, and I refused to cross that picket line.
And that used to be a cultural expectation in this country, Sly, that the working class stood with one another. And you don't cross picket lines, and in fact, you join them. I remember being in Chicago a couple summers ago with my daughter we went down there for the day to have fun, and this was right about the time of the hotel worker strike there. And as we were walking through downtown at the end of the day, heading back to where we had parked in one of those overpriced garages, thank you, Rahm Emanuel and Mayor Daley before that, we happened upon a picket line of hotel strikers, and that was the thing I taught my daughter, I think, a valuable lesson. Not only do you not cross picket lines, when you see them, you join them, because the fight of the working class wherever is the fight of the working class everywhere. And so I think that sort of culture needs to be rebuilt And that's not just about having it right on paper. But having that right on paper, Sly, is one of the first steps towards building a culture of solidarity and building the muscles that it takes to successfully wage a strike. And I think, you know, for public sector workers and private sector workers alike, we need to restore the right to strike in America so that folks can, in fact, practice what that means and get used to it and have it normed. By the way, I'm offering an amendment to the Democratic Party platform next Monday to restore the right to strike to all Americans. That not only ensures that we do things like what Russ Feingold was talking about decades ago, banning permanent replacements for striking workers, but also saying that public employees in this country have the unfettered right to strike wherever they work. And I think that's going to be a crucial aspect, not only of building real working class power to do the kinds of things like make the boss class fierce enough to provide us the sort of social welfare benefits that every other industrialized nation in this world provides to its workers. But it's also the kind of thing that can, in fact, build that countervailing fighting force.
People wonder how West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, which used to be Democratic strongholds, Oklahoma used to be a Democratic stronghold. If you go back, it isn't just the evangelical craziness or the oil industry or the coal industry. It was deunionization and right-to-work laws and busting unions that really, really damaged those states and damaged Democrats' prospects. That's why they've got to understand this isn't just about keeping a certain number of blue states blue. We got to go everywhere and have people's right to organize happen, because this should be a 50-state strategy, not just enough to get you over the Electoral College.
Well, you know, so I want to take that a step further and say it was the oil billionaires of Texas and Oklahoma who financed an unholy alliance, you know, no pun intended, with the evangelical right-wing Christians,
yes,
to not just put their politics front and center, but also to bust the unions. That's where right-to-work laws came from. It was the Dixie South, financed by oil billionaire money and backed by, you know, essentially a Christo-fascist set of preachers saying, well, unions are communist and ungodly. And they went at the unions first and broke that working class solidarity to build right-wing politics in America. And so to all the folks who might be listening to this who are saying, well, you know, I'm for abortion rights and gay marriage. I like education. I want to put more public money into that or something along those lines, sort of a middle-class suburban liberal agenda. You know, the ability to move on that kind of thing and have actual political power in the hands of the Democrats is 100% contingent on whether there is a working class in this country that is aligned with the objectives of folks like that. And that only comes from a mission of solidarity that says, yes, working class people win when we have unions and when we have strikes to fight the bosses in the public and private sector alike. And when the working class, you know, is fighting for health care and is able to win on universal social welfare measures like that, only then can we make progress on the kinds of progressivism that I think defines the political horizons for a number of middle class, you know, somewhat affluent liberal types. You know, the counterfactual or the mirror image of how the right took over America in the 20th century is how we can transform this country in the 21st century, building a fighting working class politics that delivers for the blue collar and the pink collar and no collar workers of this country.
Peter Rickman, Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers, thanks for coming to Sly's office.
Thanks for having me on, Sly. Always a pleasure.
Sly'sOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.